The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor and a real son of a gun.
And today we're talking about how to be a good boss. So frequently, people are good at making a thing, and they get promoted to be the supervisors of the other people who are making the thing without any training as to how to lead them. Do good bosses just pick up leadership skills on the job? Do they have mentors or coaches or just extraordinarily high EQs? What separates good bosses from horrible ones? And how can just so-so bosses get better at it?
First, we'll get a sense of what makes a good boss with the author of Lifehacker's brand new career advice column, Human Resource, Rob Walker.
If someone knows how to code, they know how to code. If they don't, you better train them. Or just assume that because they did something else, that they can just magically have this new ability.
Then we'll meet a real live executive coach. Admit it, you too have always wondered what the hell an executive coach does. Organizational psychologist Jen Goldman Wetzler is here to tell us how she makes bad bosses better.
Being a good leader is a lot like being a good parent.
And finally, the creator of Ruby on Rails and co-founder of Basecamp, David Heinemeier Hansen, tells us how to make a workplace that's not crazy in 5 steps.
Let's get to the show. Self-help is a segment in which we pose pressing questions to the experts on the Lifehacker team. This week, we're asking, what makes a good boss? Our guest is Rob Walker, the author of Lifehacker's brand new advice column, Human Resource.
You may know Rob as The Workologist, the column he wrote for the New York Times, or his excellent newsletter, The Art of Noticing. His new book, also called The Art of Noticing, comes out in May.
So, Rob, you've been a career advice columnist for a while now. What are some of the most common complaints that people have about bosses?
You know, the number one complaint is basically just your all-purpose jerk boss. That's what people... Usually a boss has to be, bad on several levels, like kind of mean, indifferent, often has some office favorite that they are favoring over everyone else, in particular the person who's writing to me. You know, they usually have to hit a few notes before someone gets mad enough to write to someone like me and say, what can I do about my jerk boss? But I have many, many, many jerk boss emails. And, it's all the things that make someone just a bad person. Selfishness, indifference, callousness, apparent incompetence. But I think when I sort of try to dig deep into what these people are really saying, usually indifference is the main thing, like just the boss who doesn't care about you. They care about themselves, they care about their boss, and they just couldn't care less about you or your career.
Also, there's the thing that where people get promoted and don't get any kind of training, right, about how to manage people. You just get the new job and you're told, you manage these people, but there's no sort of formal training. You're just hanging in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it varies by company, but it's a little shocking how cavalier we are about management as a skill that needs to be taught, like that you know, and it really has a major impact on other people's lives. And as you say, in many cases, there's almost no training whatsoever. It's just sort of assumed that, well, now you've risen to this position, so now you're in charge of other people. And you used to be good at the thing you did before, so maybe you'll be good at this. But, you wouldn't make that kind of set of assumptions with any hard skill. Like, you know, if someone knows how to code, they know how to code. If they don't, you better train them. Or just assume that because they did something else, that they can just magically have this new ability. But for whatever reason, it's not taken seriously in a lot of places. And that's too bad.
So there are so many challenges that come up with being a boss. And I'm curious how you advise people on stuff that seems to come up whenever we write about work or bosses at Lifehacker, stuff like giving criticism or giving feedback, which is something that I don't know which is more uncomfortable. Yes, I do. I think receiving feedback is probably more uncomfortable than giving feedback, but they're both really difficult. And they, you know, when you're a boss, there are, you know, very particular challenges.
Yeah. Well, and so when we're talking about skills that need to be taught, both of those would count, and especially the giving feedback part. And this is, you know, a sort of sub theme of the great challenge of management in general is just communication. And almost every problem stems from some failure of communication, of people talking past each other, or the boss not understanding what's going on with employees, or the employees not understanding what the boss wants, et cetera. And so feedback is the toughest part of that. And, you know, my advice to people, to managers, is often don't be such a baby. Like, people want, they find it very uncomfortable to give feedback that is anything other than sort of generically, blandly positive, right? It doesn't mean that you have to be, you know, obviously there's another subcategory of boss that's very good at giving really jerky, mean, critical feedback and yelling at you, but that's not really productive either. But just in general, like, better communication skills and being honest but not mean is really valuable and really hard and takes some practice. And yeah, receiving feedback is also, yes, it is hard because we all tend to get defensive, and maybe there could be, I don't know how you teach the skill of receiving feedback, but one of the reasons receiving feedback is so hard is because so much feedback is so poorly delivered.
That's right. You know, we talk about different techniques around giving feedback. Well, somebody on our team was talking about the compliment sandwich, or maybe it was somebody in HR who was talking about this with me, about how, and I'm not sure how I feel about this, the idea of, like, you know, you give some positive feedback on either side as the bun, and then the meat of the sandwich is the real criticism. And I don't know if that makes it go down easier, or I don't know if that fools anybody, but I guess if you're particularly deft, you can... You know, tell us, you're doing a great job. You have to stop being late, and I still love you.
Right. People argue about whether this is a good technique or not, and because, you know, the one of the risks is that, like, they don't hear the part in the middle, and they just walk away with the two compliment sides of it, and they, you know, totally miss the actual criticism, and that it's designed a little bit too much to make the person giving the feedback feel better, and which these things feed on themselves, like, that you end up really emphasizing the good things and kind of just blowing past the problem.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, I think about a lot. And when I have to give feedback, what's been helpful for me is thinking not about how, you know, how uncomfortable it is to have to criticize somebody else. You know, who am I to criticize you? I'm not perfect. You know, if you come from that perspective and you over-identify with the feeling of having been given feedback in a in an inelegant way, then that sort of can keep you from actually delivering the constructive feedback, as you said. What I try to do is think about how I can help, like, starting there and going in thinking, like, how can I help this person be better, and how can I, like, have them help me figure out what the solution is?
Yeah, and I think thinking about it this way, you know, and this is kind of what the spirit of the compliment sandwich is, in a way, is it's like, you want to deliver the feedback, but you want to contextualize it in a way that makes it clear that I'm not just here to beat you up. You know, I would almost say, so that's where I sort of come down on the compliment sandwich thing, is if it makes you, if using a technique like that will get you to actually deal with the problem in a straightforward way instead of kicking the can down the road indefinitely, then do it. Because the biggest problem is just letting things sit and being afraid to confront them.
I think that's part of a larger issue, that giving feedback, which is balancing being a boss and there are sort of innate human desire to be liked by everybody. And that's really tough, you know, especially if you are a person who maybe got to where you are to being a boss by pleasing other people, you know, which is often the case, by doing well and getting the A+.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable. It feels really uncomfortable to feel like someone might think you're a jerk. You can't, it's very difficult to be a boss without some risk of, you know, you have to be in charge. You have to be, you just won't be respected. So if you just avoid having the tough conversation, ultimately you're not taken seriously, and it's uncomfortable. But it's part of being a manager. It's not the whole of being a manager, and that's what I think people get so fixated on it that they forget that, like, oh, but the end result of this is if I can actually help this person get better at what they're doing, that's a good thing for everybody, and it's really satisfying, and it's kind of more satisfying than just having them quote unquote like me.
What about emotion when you're a boss? This is there a certain amount of emotion that is acceptable and beyond which one is inappropriate in an office?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that there's like a clean formula, but it's I'll put it this way. Like, sometimes it's okay to have these emotional, it's okay to like have it out, as long as you can circle back and build off that. When I worked in offices, some of the best long-term relationships with managers that I had included some moment of like a genuine like falling out, like really arguing about something, really disagreeing about something. And it sort of depends on where you're coming from. Are you coming from a place of just petty self-defense? Or is this argument about, and this is always what I end up saying, is like, how do you bring this back to it being about something bigger than you and me, about it being about the organization, right? Like, that's what we're all here for. And like, the reason that I'm mad at you isn't because I'm mad at you. It's because what you're doing is not helping us in the long run. And you could help us in the long run if you would do this. And by helping us, you help yourself. So I'm less sort of hung up on, I mean, obviously you shouldn't scream at people. you shouldn't say things that make your coworkers cry. Like, it's reasonable human behavior, but I think it's okay to be emotional and to be human if it signals that you care about the organization and about them, you know?
That's so interesting, what you said about bringing it back to the larger organization. And, you know, I have this like sort of mantra that I'm sure I've said on this show before that is not particularly novel, which is work is about facts, it's not about feelings. And just reminding myself of that sometimes when I do feel emotions creeping in helps to center me. But sometimes people are rude, personally rude to you, and it does feel personal. And this is whether you're a boss or not. And I guess it's a little bit more challenging if you're a boss, because there's, you know, as with a parent, there's a certain amount of shit that you're expected to take, you know, because you're the one who is supposed to be in some way taking care of your employees or looking out for them or, you know, distilling their feelings and frustrations into something productive. But what about when you are actually hurt or offended as a human being by somebody who works with you or for you?
Well, I think it's totally okay to call that out. And, you know, and in some ways you almost owe it to not just yourself and the organization, but to them to say, you know, look, and you might not want to do it in the heat of the moment. You might want to do it the next day or something, but say like, listen, you know, what you did there was problematic for this reason. And explain, like, you may not have even meant that, but here's how it came across. And I wouldn't say, you know, if I were actually doing this, I would not say like, there's a difference between here's how it came across to me and here's how it came across. Like, just make that a fact. Like, this is how you're coming across. It's not about my interpreting you. It's about your behavior. And I'm doing you a favor by kind of bringing it up. so that you can make your point. And like, you can concede if they had a point to make, then you can concede whether they, you know, mm-hmm. like, yeah, I see what you meant about the Penske file or whatever. But, you know, mm-hmm. There are other ways you could do that without without antagonizing a colleague who's trying to help you.
Have you ever gotten a letter from somebody talking about their boss and you think, oh, you're the problem?
Oh, yeah.
I think that's probably the majority of the time, isn't it?
I don't know if it's the majority, but the tell is just you know when you open the email by looking at how long it is. Because the person, if it's their fault, then they have this huge litany of like, and then she did this and she did that, and my response was perfectly fine, and then just totally unreasonably she had this other, and it just goes on and on and on. It's like, well, you're crazy.
And then it ends, and I'm writing this during a meeting, and she's yelling at me right now. This is what I'm talking about.
Oh God, whenever there's a saga, it's your fault.
It's great.
Is that the rule?
It's pretty much the rule. It's pretty much the rule.
Where does a boss turn to for support, especially if you're the, I don't know, you're the CEO of the company, right, or you're the founder of the company and you don't have a boss yourself, or you don't have a particularly sympathetic boss? You know, it seems like those would be the people who really need an advice columnist to help them.
Yeah. On the other hand, though, think about how much advice is actually, like, it may not be in the form of a column, but all the books that are written that are for like, that are for the person who is in charge, you know? From the point of view of the person who used to be in charge, here's how you can be, you know, Jack Welch or whatever. There's a lot of stuff written for that person. There's very little written in that world for the middle manager. Like, there's a sort of a built-in assumption that, well, what you really want to do is be the next Steve Jobs or something. And a lot of people don't. And we can't all do that.
Right.
And there's a real kind of lack of cultural appreciation for the person in the middle. That's the person who I sort of feel the most sympathy for, because I think that meets your definition, like that, yeah, that like that person needs advice too. And where do they turn? You know, they could turn to an advice columnist, but it's harder for them because they have a more limited set of peers, and they're between these two, you know, you're in charge of some people and somebody's in charge of you. And that's a tough place to be, but it's also the most common place to be.
So before we let you go, tell us about the human resource column. It's coming to Lifehacker in mid-February. And what sort of questions are you looking for? And then tell us how people can submit questions.
So it is a, you know, water cooler therapy column is how I think of it, which is meaning come one, come all, in terms of whatever kind of workplace dilemma you might be facing, whether it's the bothersome person in the cubicle next to you, or whether it's the boss who's stymieing your career, or whether it's, you know, coping with burnout, or, you know, anything. The kind of stuff that you would just ask a colleague about or whatever, but when you just need a fresh perspective, because that's really the essence of advice columns, is just giving someone a fresh, disinterested perspective, right? And that's all I try to do. So any kind of questions like that that are related to work in any way whatsoever, humanresource@lifehacker.com.
Great.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Thank you.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping Dogs Lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Now it's time for the interview, where we interview someone. Today, we're talking with executive coach Jennifer Goldman Wetzler. Jen is an organizational psychologist who's consulted senior executives at companies like Citigroup, IBM, and Intel. Jen, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely.
Tell us about what an executive coach does.
Sure. An executive coach is a cheerleader and really there for people who are either looking to take their career to the next level or struggling in some way, and usually some combination of both.
And do people generally come to you directly, or do their bosses say you need some executive coaching? How does that work?
It depends on the situation. It's always through an organization. So I only work inside of organizations. And the reason for that is primarily because I'm an organizational psychologist, but also because I believe that coaching somebody outside of their context makes it much more difficult to actually be helpful to them. Coaching somebody inside of the context where they live and work and play enables me to get to know the people around them. And that provides such rich data for me to then be able to help them. So if somebody says, this is what I want to do, this is what I'm up to, and then I hear from other people that they're really struggling in that area, and other people often have great ideas for them about how they could improve. And so, you know, it's not rocket science. It doesn't take a lot, but I need that data from those folks.
So how does that work? Like, what you're describing sounds totally terrifying, if I'm honest. The idea of having someone come in from the outside and go to all of this person's colleagues and say, what are your ideas for how this person could improve? And then taking it back to that person and receiving that kind of feedback seems like it would be a lot. Mm-hmm. Is that generally what you do? Like, how do you begin a process when someone comes to you for coaching?
Yeah. So you begin not by going out and interviewing everybody's friends and colleagues, but by building relationship and trust and rapport with the person who I'm coaching. So that's really the first piece of the work. I wouldn't let that go on for too long. So pretty early on, I do go and interview people 360 degrees around who I'm coaching. And the way that we set it up is that it's a confidential and anonymous process. And there are a lot of things that I do in those interviews themselves to allow people to speak freely and openly without worrying about what they're saying being identifiable to them specifically. So there's both setting up the interviewees to feel comfortable saying the truth. And then there's also setting up the person who I'm coaching to be ready, open, willing to hear the feedback. It's absolutely true that if you are thinking about coaching, but you're not open to any kind of feedback, then coaching is not going to be, well, coaching in this way with 360 interviews is not going to work for you. Mm-hmm. So you do need to be aware that either there's something you're striving toward that you just haven't figured out how to do yet, or that you have already been made aware by others around you that there's something that that you need help with. Mm-hmm. But kind of a short answer to the question is, at core, there's confidentiality and anonymity. And oftentimes, you know, delivering the feedback to somebody who's being coached is difficult. There can be a lot of defense mechanisms.
Can you give us like an example of the general issues that bring people to you?
Mm-hmm. A major one is, I'm doing a lot of things right. I'm leading this organization. I'm the CEO of a company. And yet there are relationship dynamics that are happening between me and people on my team that are not going well for me. And I know that because there have been some people who have been willing to tell the truth directly to me, or I sense it because things are just not going the way that I know they need to go, especially if I want to take this company to the next level.
Like, do they come in and sit down in your office, or are you sitting down in their office? Like, what's the setting like?
Yeah. I come to them because I want to see people in their natural environment. I want to see what their day is like. I want to see how they're interacting with people. There's so many details that I pick up just by watching how somebody moves, how somebody sits with me, how people interact with them when they're walking down the hallway. So there's a lot of rich data there.
So you're really immersing yourself in their environment,
yes.
It sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
The question that I'm dying to ask you, because I'm pretty certain the answer is going to be fascinating, is what are the differences you see as far as the challenges that your clients have between men and women?
Hmm. Oh, that's a great question. Well, I might choose to say something about similarities, mm-hmm. but since you asked about differences, I will start there. So men who I'm coaching often come with issues about lack of trust on the team. People don't trust the person. They've made decisions without getting people's input, and it really hurts people, and they just don't trust the leader. Other times, it's anger issues. So people who, typically men, who are just openly angry and have no trouble showing their anger in just the most, you know, stereotypically horrible ways, like what you would see on a movie screen. So helping the leader learn how to manage the anger, and also often helping the other people around that leader learn how to manage when the person gets angry. And then with women, you know, what I noticed is they're getting dinged on every side. So I've literally collected feedback, 360 feedback on behalf of a woman leader, where people said she works too hard and, you know, but we know she doesn't have the resources that she needs to do the job well. And, you know, she's taking her phone into the bathroom with her. She's running around all the time. She's never somewhere where you can never find her. Her people are stretched too thin. And so then, you know, we'll deliver this feedback to her, and then also after that to her boss. And I'll say to the boss, so, you know, what do you make of this? And she'll, you know, she's been trying to get him to say that he'll provide more people, more resources for her, more money, more people. And he just hasn't done it. And in the face of this data, he'll say she really needs to stop being so busy. You know, like no acknowledgement that she's struggling in the context of a place where she's been asking for resources and not getting them. So that has been among the more painful experiences that I've had as a coach, is to watch that interaction unfold. I will say in the particular example that I just described, we were able to make a difference. So it was so glaringly obvious that the feedback of she's too busy and her team is stretched too thin was not just about her lack of ability as a manager or as a leader, but really was about a very real resource problem. And she and I were able to brainstorm some solutions and bring them to her manager in a way that she had not been able to do before. And so, so sometimes issues like that.
And so that being particular to one particular client, is that something that you see often with women, that they're not being supported and that is contributing to their difficulties with their leadership role?
Yes. And combined with that is a belief that may be so longstanding and internalized inside of the female leader of, I should be able to do this without the resources I've been asking for. I'm not getting them, so I should be able to do it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, just running themselves ragged, trying to figure out a way to do it. And so you can see how these are like puzzle pieces. They fit so well. Yeah. People who are unwilling to give resources, women who are, you know, asking, but not asking in a way that provides solutions, kind of just asking without saying, here's who we might rejigger, or here's where the money could come from, and then expecting themselves to just grin and bear it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a recipe for disaster.
It kind of reminds me of sometimes a life hacker. We come up with hacks that are sort of personal things you can do, but in fact, the problem is right. Institutional and cultural. And there's no, you know, like you can't work harder mm-hmm. and expect to improve when you're not getting paid enough, and when you're not getting benefits, and mm-hmm. you know, when the system isn't built to right. support you.
Yeah, and piggybacking on that, it seems like there must be similarities, and I know your area of expertise is organizational psychology, but what are the overlaps with sort of family systems therapy? Mm-hmm. Because it sounds very much like family therapy that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a ton of overlap. And in fact, I have been known to sometimes say, depending, again, not this is not good advice for all clients, but for many people, being a good leader is a lot like being a good parent. And so it can help sometimes to think of your team as your children and your family. But absolutely. I think one of the reasons why coaching can sometimes get a bad rap and not actually be so useful is because of what you just pointed out, Alice, which is that it's a systemic issue that's getting attention at an individual level. So I'm always looking, and my coaches who work with me are always looking at multiple levels. In organizations, we're looking at the individual level, we're looking at the team level, we're looking at the division level, we're looking at the organizational level. And you need to kind of be able to flow back and forth amongst those levels in order to often create real change in the organization or for the person.
And what does success look like in a situation like this? How do you say, my work is done and we have solved the problem, or yeah. we've made movement on the problem?
Yeah. One nice thing about collecting that feedback up front is that it actually makes it very easy to know whether you've done a good job or not. So in the report that I deliver to our clients is very simple. It starts with an executive summary usually, but then what's working well? What is this person doing well as a leader? What could this leader be doing differently, improving? And then a set of recommendations. And I make the recommendations, my coaches make the recommendations based not only on what our own best advice is, given what we've heard from people in the interviews, but also given what we've heard, we've asked people, we've said, you know, if you were this person, what would you recommend? What would you ask them to do? So we make these recommendations, and then the work is not done there. So then we're obviously feeding back the report to the person who's being coached. We're then meeting with a third person. Sometimes it's a member of the board. If I'm coaching a CEO, it's a member of the board. If I'm coaching someone who reports to the CEO, then the third person is the CEO. And we're having a three-way conversation about, so here's what this leader who's being coached has decided they would like to work on. Here's the top one, two, or three things that they have said, this is what I think I should be working on based on both the feedback in the report and the recommendations in the report. And it's that third person's job to say, yay or nay, you know, yes, that sounds great. Or no, I think you got it all wrong and you should really be thinking about X, Y, Z. Or typically it's some combination of, yep, that sounds great. And, you know, here's one other thing to think about. And so then we've got our marching orders. And so it might be, you know, typically it's a number of months, anywhere from, you know, 6 to 18 months of working with somebody closely. To help them fulfill on those one, two, or three big goals. And of course, we'll break them down into, well, you know, what does that look like? What does that actually look like to do those things that you said you're going to do? And we'll often run that by the third person as well. And so by the end of the, you know, check-in points, typically we'll check in at 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, you know, every 3 months, we're checking in with each other and also with the third person. To see how are we doing? Are we moving towards the things that we said we're going to do? So I think coaching is one of the most measurable things that actually happens in organizational life today.
Let's say you're in a smaller group and you're not an executive, but you are managing people and you want to get better and get the kind of coaching that you're talking about, but don't necessarily have the resources. Mm-hmm. What can somebody in that situation do to kind of improve their own emotional intelligence and organizational intelligence?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a ton you can do. First of all, go onto YouTube and type in coaching, and I'm sure you can be coached by video. Tons of books. And while I work inside of organizations, there are plenty of coaches who work directly with individuals. And so often when somebody is in a position where they're in an organization and their organization is not willing to pay for them to be coached, they will ask me, well, what else can I do? And I'll refer them out to individual coaches who do that kind of work. And so that can be incredibly helpful and incredibly rewarding. Typically, in that case, that coach is not able to have access to the people around the person. So it's a different kind of coaching because they're only working with the information that the person seeking coaching has given them. Mm-hmm. But it still can be valuable.
And so who are the people on YouTube and who have written books whose expertise you recommend if people don't have the resources to see a coach themselves?
So I think it depends on, like everything else, it depends on what you're struggling with. But on the productivity side, you have people like Brendan Burchard and, you know, the classics, Tony Robbins, who will help you with how to think of yourself as a leader, how to change your mindset so that you're seeing yourself in a different way, and also giving you the productivity tools and tips to be more productive.
And any books in the meantime that you recommend?
Yeah, well, a couple of oldies but goodies in the negotiation and conflict management space are Getting to Yes by Roger Fisher, Bill Urey, and Bruce Patton, and Difficult Conversations by Stone, Patton, and Heen. So those are great. Difficult Conversations people find really accessible, and it's a great primer on how to give feedback in a way that lands on people the way you want it to, how to, you know, say the truth and have it land in the way that you're expecting and hoping.
Mm-hmm. How do you know when you need coaching and how do you know when you need therapy?
The easiest way to differentiate between therapy and coaching is that coaching is future-oriented, coaching is action-oriented, and that therapy tends to be more reflective, looking into the past, looking for reasons why you have been acting the way you're acting or why things have occurred the way they've occurred, versus coaching that might touch on those, but then very quickly will move more towards action. Hmm. So in my work as a coach, I absolutely do go there with clients. So we will go into, you know, well, why do you think that has happened? And we'll talk about childhood, we'll talk about childhood family, we'll talk about childhood friends, we'll talk about traumatic experiences. And if my sense is there's something that opens up for somebody that is beyond my level of expertise as a executive coach or as an organizational psychologist, then we'll talk about, you know, how can you get what you need outside of this work.
Hey, this is David Heimer Hansen. I am the co-author of It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work and the co-founder of the software company Basecamp. Here are my top 5 steps for creating a calm workplace without the crazy. Step 1, start defending the quality of time. So many workplaces today seem obsessed with getting as many hours as possible out of their employees. 60 hours, 80 hours, in some extreme cases even 100 hours. That's simply unnecessary. It's counterproductive. It doesn't result in the good, diligent, careful work that most creative industries really need. 40 hours is enough. 40 hours is plenty. So instead of trying to stretch out the time, try to protect the time that's already there, protecting those 40 hours. Stop squandering them on all the stuff that puncture the day and turn a work day into a series of work moments. That means fewer meetings. It means you stop sharing the calendar since it's so easy to reserve other people's time. You should be working diligently to ensure that people can get 3, 4, 5 hours of uninterrupted time where no one is bothering them and they can dive deep and go the distance on the work that they have to do. It simply doesn't work to squeeze the lemon for every last drop. Step 2, And related to step one, don't celebrate workaholics. Don't go out of your way to call attention to people who've pulled an all-nighter, who stayed during the weekend, who've quote-unquote sacrificed for the company, or even worse, as some companies do, sacrificed for the family. The company is not a family, and for the company to ask sort of sacrifices of their employees as though they were a family is, quite frankly, disgusting. It doesn't lead to a calm workplace. What you should be celebrating instead is people who get their work done within the 40 hours, within normal hours, the people who are wrapped up and ready to go by 5 o'clock. Step three, get rid of dreadlines. Dreadlines is the kind of deadlines that we all hate. The idea of a fixed scope, fixed amount of time, and fixed resources that just don't add up. You can't square the triangle, as it were. It's fine to have an intention. It's fine to have an outline of what you think something is going to be or should be, but you have to leave the details for the people who are actually doing the work as they're filling in to do the work. Step four, compromise on quality. That's related to this idea of the flexible scope. Not everything needs to be the best. Not everything needs to involve whatever it takes. Most things, most of the time, just have to be good enough. That doesn't mean that you don't have high standards as an organization. It simply means that you choose where your high standards apply, and you apply them only to the places where it truly, really matters. Step five, curb your ambition. Society and the industry has too much hustle mania going on. We're not getting better work. We're not getting better people. We're not getting better products because people pledge allegiance to this idea of hustle mania, where they have to be simply working all the time to arrive and strive for these impossible ambitions. Because the problem with ambitions is, of course, that they never stop once you reach your goals. Once you reach the goals that you've set, well, we'll just declare some new goals that are even further away and even harder to reach, and then you're back on the same treadmill. That's one of the reasons for why we at Basecamp have decided that we don't have any goals. We don't have any explicit targets or metrics that we have to hit. We're focused on doing great work with good people and being fair to customers and the people that we deal with. And that's enough. It's enough to have a goal of staying in business and making a good product. So that's my five steps to creating a calm workplace without the crazy. There's a bunch more steps and a bunch more ideas in my book, It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work, that I wrote with Jason Fried. Thank you so much for your time.
So now it's time for Upgrade of the Week. Every week we talk about that one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Melissa, what's your upgrade this week?
I got these absolutely hideous looking flip-flops. I had seen a friend wearing them and around the house and commented in a less rude way, what are those flip-flops? They are absolutely hideous.
They're so hideous, they must be great.
They're so hideous, there has to be a story behind them. And there were, and there is, or there was a story. And that story is that they are special flip-flops that make every muscle in your body feel better. They're called recovery flip-flops, and they're made by a company called Oofos, O-O-F-O-S. And I tried them on. I couldn't believe how comfortable they were. I couldn't believe how much recovery it seems I needed. I think they're probably meant for, like, marathon runners, which I am not, but, you know, I do walk around New York City all day, and so I got myself a pair of these not very attractive but very comfortable rubber flip-flops, and all day I think about how I want to go home and put them on, and I'm thinking about it right now. They're so comfortable. I highly recommend them. They've upgraded my life. They're great for if you've, I don't know, gone jogging and overexerted yourself or something, and you're calves and hips are hurting, they feel great.
Jen, what's your upgrade?
Well, because we've been talking about coaching has been on my mind more, even more than normal. And so in true coach fashion, I will talk about my renewed, this is not totally new upgrade, but every once in a while I stop doing it and then remember to do it. So this week is the renewed nightly check-in, nightly review. And my nightly review is that I ask myself, I have to put three bullets under each of these questions. I have to fill it out. So first question is, what worked well about today? Second question is, what would I do differently about what happened today? Third question is, what am I really looking forward to about tomorrow? And the final question is, what am I really nervous about tomorrow? And actually, the final question is part A and part B. So that's part A. And part B is, how could I mitigate that or make that maybe go more smoothly? So that is my little nightly ritual.
Wow. How long does that take?
Not long, surprisingly. And it's actually really fun because it makes you think about all the great things that happened today and all the fun things that are, well, hopefully fun and exciting things that are happening the next day. So it's more, usually more fun than scary. And it actually often gives me very good ideas about how to make the next day go more smoothly, which is much, you know, just really nice.
You mean, so like, you don't think that it might be more productive to just lie in bed and worry?
This is a new thought to me. I don't understand.
Right. Yeah. That's all the other days
right.
when I forget to do it.
Or fall asleep and just grind your teeth together.
Exactly.
Down
that
to dust. Dust.
Yep. Just, wake up with a migraine, blind in one eye.
Just pain shooting down your whole body.
Those are loads more fun.
That's pretty fun. I don't know.
Alice, what's your upgrade?
So I have long been a fan of Instagram. I like Instagram the most of any of the social media. I've decided it's the least damaging to my psyche, unless it's the middle of the winter and it's really cold out and everybody's at some kind of tropical island vacation and I'm stuck here, then I have to stop looking at it. But lately I've been using it more as kind of a reference than using it as sort of social media. So I've been following a lot of accounts of two things that I'm particularly interested in right now. And one of them is artists, and the other is, this is weird, but the other one is mobility. So people who do kind of mobility drills and flexibility, because I am becoming increasingly stiff and working in an office, sitting all the time. My hips are becoming something that is not normal. So I've been working a lot of mobility. So now I've been creating on Instagram these collections of the mobility posts that I found the most useful and the artists who are really inspiring me, because I'm trying to get kind of my art practice back on. And I've been thinking about other ways to use it, like recipes, parenting tips, you know, just like things, inspirational quotes, like stuff when I'm really feeling down. Do I need like a collection of that stuff? It's almost like I'm using Instagram as like what I used to use Pinterest for, but I don't know. I like Instagram more. So that's what I'm using.
Nice. And I think that Pinterest would be very disappointed to hear that.
Sorry, Pinterest.
Yeah.
Maybe they can merge into whatever you were almost going to say.
Instagram.
Pinstagram.
Pinstagram.
Okay, I'm missed.
Thank you again.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced this week by Abu Zafar. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Our theme music is by Slowbiz. And Brad Fisher mixed the episode.
To ask a career question of our new advice columnist, Rob Walker, write him at humanresource@lifehacker.com and look for his column, Human Resource on Lifehacker, debuting mid-February. If you've got thoughts about the Upgrade or life in general, email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com or look, leave us a voice message at 347-687-8109.
Follow Lifehacker on Twitter at Lifehacker and on Facebook at facebook.com/Lifehacker. If you've got a minute, review us on Apple Podcasts. We'd really appreciate it. And while you're online, you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.